Who is responsible? That man, our enemy, that wicked Haman. As Esther has put the case, Haman is a traitor to the king, as well as an enemy of the Jews. As she points to this wicked Haman, she senses her triumph and notes the terror of Haman. He might well be terrified. Esther's words to the king had been an eye-opener for him also, because he had not known Esther's nationality. The realization that he had inadvertently threatened the queen's life was a knockout blow on top of his earlier humiliation. Now, old Haman hasn't had the best of days. The past 24 to 36 hours have brought him nothing but grief. First, he had to trumpet the praises of Mordecai throughout the city of Susa, and now the queen herself is accusing him to the king. He is downright terrified, and rightly so. We, on the other hand, are cheering because we want justice. We want good rewarded and we want evil punished. Haman ought not to be running loose calling the shots. They ought to finish him off, which is exactly what the king does. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, "Behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king." And the king said, "Hang him on it." So they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. Esther chapter 7, verses 9 and 10. All the time Haman was having the gallows built, he could see, enthusiastically anticipate, Mordecai impaled there. Now he is condemned to die there himself. We call this irony. Theologians call it sovereignty. I call it God's surprising sovereignty. I can remember a time early on in my ministerial training when the sovereignty of God was frightening to me, not understanding its implications as fully as I do now some 35 years later. I felt it would make me passively and virtually irresponsible. Furthermore, I feared what it would do to my theology of evangelism. If I really threw myself into this doctrine, God could become a distant deity, sort of a celestial brute, pushing and maneuvering his way through nameless humanity as he did what he pleased to get what he wanted. I could see my zeal waning and my passion for souls drained to the point of indifference. Through a series of events far too numerous and complicated to describe, I've come to realize that rather than being frightened by God's sovereignty, I'm comforted in it. Since he alone is God, and since he, being God, does all things well, and in doing them has only good as his goal, how could I do anything but embrace it? Does that mean I can explain it? No, only rarely when hindsight yields insight. Does that mean I always anticipate it? No, like you, I occasionally rush to judgment or respond in panic, wondering why he is so silent, allowing wrong to run its course so long. But looking back in more reasonable moments with my emotions under better control, his control, I can see what he was about. I can even see why he delayed or why he acted when he did. Usually, I freely admit, I think he is awfully slow. I can't number the times I've pleaded, "Oh God, please hurry up." And I'm usually surprised, though I shouldn't be, at how beautifully things work out. But the good news is that I've come full circle. I find enormous comfort in knowing, in the final analysis, God is God, and he will have his way when he pleases and for his glory. What could be better than that? In all the mystery of his waiting and working, and in all the wrong of our doing and undoing, he can still be trusted. The big thing is that you and I remain sensitive to those moments when he breaks the silence, which we're tempted to call absence, and suddenly intervenes on our behalf. Furthermore, I'm more than ever convinced over the lost. But in the final analysis, their salvation rests with him, not with me. Esther's ability to cooperate at those all-important moments causes her to stand head and shoulders above her contemporaries. Being sensitive to God's interventions every day. Since we are trapped in this earthbound cage, this little space where light is often diffused and God is sometimes silent, how can we be sensitive to his interventions? What do we do when we, like Job, struggle in the fog with God's silence, when we're convinced that his silence means absence? Please be assured, he is not absent. He may be silent, but he's not absent. So let me close this chapter with three life preservers that have helped me stay afloat during my own scary experiences on the lake when the fog seemed unusually thick. First, the fog on your lake is neither accidental nor fatal. So while swimming, listen very carefully and patiently for his voice. Some days you will be seized with panic and dog paddle like mad. You'll try various approaches, breaststroke, butterfly, backstroke, float. But all the time, you want to be listening for his voice. I urge you to listen with great sensitivity because his message will come in various ways.